This is the Silicon Springboard Podcast. My name is Dom Pateau. I'm the founder of Joyforge Labs. Silicon Springboard is about telling the stories of founders who've built great businesses, not despite the challenges of South Africa, but because of them. Those challenges have forged great personalities, great opportunities, and great businesses out of that. And today's story is that of Donovan Bailey, who built a business called Expand a Brand that has solved many interesting problems and challenges, rebuilt itself many times, and gone global. Here we go. This is the story of Donovan Bailey. So recently I put out a LinkedIn post about the USA and South Africa and how there's, you know, great opportunities for South African businesses to enter the US. And Don reached out and we spoke a little bit about the struggles and challenges and opportunities that the USA presents. And we got to understand a little bit more about his business. He's the CEO of ExpanderSign International. In the US, it's called Expander Brand. He's been building and running this business for many, many years. It's a really interesting story of growing a South African company and going international. And today I want to just find out more about him, his story, and a little bit about ExpanderSign as well, and how he's come around to build such an interesting business. So Don, first question. You guys have done some pretty innovative work. I was quite surprised when I was looking at the story. You say you guys invented both the A-frame and the flying banner and various other things. I mean, I've bought flying banners and I've used those for businesses. Are you guys the inventors of all of that?
Yeah, correct. To be fair, it was started by my father, who was in a beach shelter tent manufacturing for Walmart in the States. He's always been an exporter. And then it was endorsed by cancer associations to be used on beaches. And through doing that, it started getting involved with ad agencies that asked it for printing as giveaways. And then someone one day in an ad agency said to my father, can that not fold up like an A-frame? And he took it to the side, made it. And, you know, the great thing, I think a lot of this story is about entrepreneurship. Had to be playing squash with a guy from MTN in those days, big cellular company trying to get out there. And he mentioned it to the guy, and the guy said, that sounds great. How much? And my father blurted out a price, and he didn't flinch. And he said, oh, I'll take 10 for the Comrades Marathon, which was coming up. So quick scrabble, having to learn how to make it print well, put it out, and then the phone started ringing. And that was 1997, last century. And then in 2000, a colleague of my father that used to do all his design work and his furniture business, brother owned a fishing rod company, took a fishing rod, bent it, and put a piece of fabric on it. And patented it and then had a nervous breakdown. And his family literally approached us and said, we've got this idea, and we looked at it. And another good story is my father and I'd joined by then, had looked at it as well, and didn't think it was anything great, but thought we have to do the right thing and help them. And we took it on and literally took it to market, and it just went crazy. So if you look before those dates, soft signage at events wasn't a big thing because the printing and techniques weren't really necessarily available. And yeah, that's how it sort of started, those two products. And then it evolved from there. At the end of the day, now we make a printed piece of fabric and we put it on a stick.
But since then, you guys have continued. You've done a few other things. I saw some things that you put there, you know, the Dakar Rally. So some very impressive things. But what actually impressed me was you guys are doing, you built your own textile production facility, looks like. And then you've gone into going to using recycled plastics.
Correct. Yeah, so, I mean, the vertical integration happened purely out of frustration. I mean, you know, making clothes is easy. If you've got a fault in a textile making clothes, you cut around it. But if you just made a 20-meter banner for Coke and there's a fault in the last meter, you go back to the beginning and start again. And fabric moves. Fabric, is a good textile guy will tell you, is alive. And I used to buy from the Far East, and I just got so frustrated with quality, and that was the decision was made. That is our blood, is textiles, and we needed to own it. So that big decision was made, and we started our own textile weaving mill.
We hear about the textile industry in South Africa has been destroyed and, you know, opening up to China, and the imports obviously impacted probably sort of mass-produced textiles. But what you're telling me is that there's been a competitive advantage. You're bringing production back from China to South Africa, but for a very let's call it niche, not mass market, but high quality space in which you guys are in. And you found that that was was the right way to go. What were the challenges in doing that? And did it take quite a lot of convincing people to let's put a lot of our money into that rather than just buying from China? Because surely China must be able to do it better, right?
Sure, we'll never compete to the Chinese when it comes to just mass scale. But we do make special chemicals we put into fabrics and everything, and that's all our IP. So we like to call it a boutique textile, you know, weaving. So that's in the niche just for our little industry, which is minuscule compared to the clothing and home upholsteries. Yeah. When we did the business plan, and all entrepreneurs will know, don't do death by spreadsheet. And it's budget, smudge it. And the hardest line on any budget is the top line. Well, how much are you going to sell people? And you go, a lot. But we knew exactly how much we would sell because we would be fulfilling expanded science requirements. So we did it based on that business model. And it kept making sense, which also makes you very worried when you start saying, if it looks too good to be true, it isn't true. And it was with a push, pulling the trigger and buying this plant. And then it arrived, and at about 15 containers arrived. We'd rented the building, and there was this big Meccano set that had to be put together. And then the growing pain started. And, you know, luckily South Africa does have a big skill base. I found one of the last three master loom tuners around. And he had a stroke. And I remember visiting him, and he said, well, what do you want with me? I'm buggered. And he said, I want what's in your head. Come and teach us how to make textiles. And what a journey, you know, to loom tuning as a dying art. It's funny, you know, with the new generation who want to sit in front of computers, there are not many skills left to guys that are the art of running looms.
So you yourselves, your father was an entrepreneur and had businesses, but was still, I'm sure, an interesting journey for you, choosing to go into this direction. How did you get started? You know, what were the triggers along the way that you know helped you get into this in the first place?
Yeah, look, I mean, my dad's been a big influence on me from a young age, my brother and all of us. One thing, he'd say, show me your hands. He'd say, use them, make something, do something. Nothing was for free. And I always respect that looking back at the time. He always goes, buggy old man, he's always a bit tough. But he was always been a serial entrepreneur. You know, started making woodwork in the back in Johannesburg, well, born in Pietermaritzburg, because he had a young family to survive. And then selling it, and that grew into a worldwide business with 600 staff from Japan to USA that he sold to Barlow Rand at age 38. And then has always been that serial entrepreneur getting into the next business. And the biggest lesson I had was when you had to be, you know, accounting, become an auditing clerk, I wasn't keen. And he said, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, I don't know. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, I've got a business I'm going to shut down. If you're really brave and you want to learn, try and fix it. And it's going to be hard. If you're really going to, and that's going to be better than any university you have. And I took on this business, which was an awning business making carports and the likes, had huge bad debt. The old man had bought it in a bundle. And the debt was sitting in all projects that weren't finished. So first lesson, collecting money. And the hardest, horrible thing, asking people for money. But you have to do it if you've got to survive. And that little, you know, that little, and it was a little business. I think it had 48 people. Taught me a lot. But my dream was to fly airplanes always. And I just tried to find, I was working, you know, Entrepreneurs Week work 9 days a week. Not finding time to fly. And I realized at that point there was an opportunity, someone wanting to buy it. I turned this little business around to buy me out and to hop and go to London and really learn the skills of an accountant and see the world and save the money to come back and just focus on my flying, which I did for 2 years. Great experience too. Learned the people that I met there came back to my business later and expanded a site. So I got into a sports marketing firm called Bell Pottinger, which most Africans will know have a bad reputation. I was the company accountant, dealing with marketing people and events, so never knew it would come back to me later in my life. I finally left there, became a commercial pilot, ended up working in Africa for the UN and basically in war zones. And it came one point, end of 98, we lost 2 aircraft in 3 days. And that's when that little epiphany moment where, hang on, I actually don't mind being in the office so much. Losing people that you know is always hard, and it's a very tough environment. Plus, I was getting a bit long in the tooth, had a girlfriend for a long time, it was time to start committing to certain things, and disappearing 8 weeks of time in the bush wasn't great. And yeah, I came back end of 98, beginning of 99, proposed, ended up sitting in front of my father, and he said, "What now?" And we were just chatting. And he had started Expandersign by default, as I mentioned earlier. And he said, "I want to export." And I said, "How?" And he said, "I haven't really thought about it." And I said, "Well, hang on. I've got all these sports marketing contacts. I'll give it a go." And, yeah, we packed up, got married and packed up and went to London. And then I thought I knew how to sell. I had to learn the art of selling, started a business from scratch. And then that's why I've got gaps in my teeth. Those are the ones that got punched out in England.
Tell me a bit about, so you land in England. You've been working for big company, Bell Pottinger. Now you are, you know, the lone man there in England. What was that like? So tell me, what were some of the stories? How did you get off the ground there? You said, you know, it wasn't so easy.
I think I've said it to you before. You know what's sad is schools don't teach us how to sell. It's like an art. Doesn't matter how clever you are, how big your degree in entrepreneurship, I think the biggest core, it's easy to make things, it's hard to sell things. And I thought I could sell. And it's that every day looking at the phone, and when you look at it and it looks like a big brick, it's a problem. It needs to be light as a feather that you pick this thing up and you build confidence. So I had a lot of contacts, a lot of doors open, but the English don't like change. And I had solutions. I'd seen the bills we paid as an event company transporting massive signage when it could have all been solved with what I had. And I just couldn't get people convinced to change. And I met, through luck, a very wealthy man, a very successful IT guy, who had a chat with. And his words were to me, force them to change. Promise them their money back. And I thought, that's a bit daunting. And he said, ask for the order. What have they got to lose? And that all led ultimately to a massive deal I did for Adidas with all their soccer development. One of those deals where you can't even fund it yourself. I couldn't even fund the VAT and the duties to come into the country. So I had to do the three Fs, friends, families, and fools, borrow the money to get it in the country, deliver it, get it paid. And then that gave me the confidence just to bang on doors.
And was it that one deal that did that for you?
Yeah, because it was, you know, I was scoffed at and laughed at. And the first meeting I had with the guy at Adidas, I remember him flicking through his diary and giving me a date 6 weeks in advance. And he goes, "Oh, he's not very interested." And then arriving late, because I honestly we had a blowout in the car with my brother, and we arrived late, and I rushed through the thing in my suit, sweating, and I walked down, I got in the car with my brother, and we'd driven London to Manchester, which is a good 7 hours. Basically turned around and went back despondent, and he phoned me the next day and said, "I think you need to meet my development team. Come back." And I did that trip another 5 times. And when he announced the scale of the order, he said, "Can you do that?" I said, "Of course we can. We do it all the time." Meanwhile, I've never done an order that size. Said, "No problem." And then when it all arrived, he said, "Well, look, our first big event's in Newcastle with the English football team. Would you like to attend or be part of it?" And I said, "Well, let me check my diary, of course." And I said, "Of course." And I loaded my car. I had no suspension travel left to take. And then I arrived there before they did, and I decorated the fields. And then he arrived, and he was blown away. You know, they were so well decked out with Adidas. And I got ahead of the GQ magazine was a picture of Kevin Keegan, the then English coach, standing there with my signage behind it. And that literally did change everything. When I could flick that photo out and say, look what we did, basically made it life a lot easier for me. And then from there, one or two trade shows got me into Germany, Spain, Ireland. And the business just started, kept growing and growing. And to the point I used to be stuck behind my desk. And the old man sort of announced to me one day, he said that he's really battling running the factory. And he said, "Well, why don't you come back and we'll do a deal."
So you get a couple of successes on your belt, but you start missing home, and you have the discussion with the old man. He says, "Okay, let's do a deal. Now you're going to have to prove yourself, I assume." And this is a different job now, different set of challenges. So what were some of the important moments, you know, in those first couple of years?
I'd say Marmon's very good with people if he likes you. So it was just formulating. He had started a business shooting from the hip from nothing, and it was just happening so fast. So as much as we hate procedures and standards and things like that, I had to get that all in place. First big challenge. We were only 48 of us, and we were evolving so quickly. We were the first people to adapt to digital printing onto textiles. And there was no skill set. So we bought this machinery. And the engineers, there was no one to help us, which was the best thing that ever happened to us. We designed production systems. We couldn't buy anything off the shelf.
Could you help us understand maybe one of these like big jobs? What is it like? So, you get an order and design. And it'd be interesting to know one which like kind of went wrong, but you guys rescued. You know, what does this look like to run this kind of operation?
last year I had a fire in the factory. It's the most terrifying phone call to get. A machine blew up in the middle of the night. I arrived there, my night shift guys, eyes were bright red, the outside saying, sorry, sorry. And I'm saying, guys, it happens, it's done. By the time the fire brigade got out, there was just, it was more than ankle deep in water. And I got in there, I looked around, my managers had all, they lived further away than me, got to the office quicker than me. And we stood in there and we looked at each other and I said to the guys, go home, you are buggered, your eyes. And I said, no, boss, we stay here, we fix this with you. And I got an amazing video. There's seven of them. We swept till the morning when the bulk of the staff arrived. Announced what happened, and they just said, it's fine. We will do it. We'll do it, boss. And they all closed off, hands, knees, scrub, polish. Half past nine, we're up and running again.
Wow.
And, you know, we
so got, no delay to production. You guys
just... No, there was. We lost the machine, so we just had to work even harder through the nights. But, yeah, I said to my management team, I actually think, you know, and you've got to find the positives. It was a positive. There was a very good click, the staff coming together again. We've been through COVID. We've been through Knox. It was just seeing everyone, management, everyone out there cleaning. You know, we had offices flooded, everything, and everyone just got on it. Most people didn't have shoes on that day. So it's quite funny, walk around in those shoes. And, you know, letters and apologies to me. They're sad it's happened, but just thanks that they still got their jobs.
But you say all of this with such, you know, you've taken the knocks and you've kind of rolled with them and gone through them and still incredibly positive. But, you know, were there moments where you thought, I want to give up. I want to go do something simpler. Let me just go get a job with some nice corporate or just retire. I don't need therapy. The money anymore. You know,
no, I've been caught in the garage. I've been caught in the garage sitting in my car staring at the ceiling. The wife says, what are you doing? I'm just saying, yeah, I'm having one of those moments. Should I carry on? And, you know, we go back, you know, we had 9/11. A whole export business shut down overnight. Then if a little bit after, there was a volcano, if you remember, Icelandic volcano, yeah. All flights stopped, and it can't happen again. And then we had 2008 happened. So there's been all these events, and then COVID, I was in France when it happened, COVID, when the lockdowns happened, had to get home. Staff phoned me, said, well, we're not allowed even come to work. What do we do? And, yeah, all the way through that, we laughed at, okay, so worst case, it's 2 months. We'll pay everyone for 2 months, because if we don't, these people are going to starve. We've got to keep everyone alive. So 2 months came 2 years. It was April 2022 where they finally opened events again. And I said, guys, we've got to look at like we just started a new business again. And that is always tough. As you know, the first 3 years are the hardest. And it literally is that. I mean, US, our big guys, the big agencies were gone. They shut down, just didn't pay their accounts. Everyone gone. And they all started rebuilding, new people. So it felt like we started from scratch again. And we're in a very different industry. And we did pivot. We made masks. But masks, you know, to talk about Bitcoin, it went up at an excessive rate. We thought, this is lovely. And literally over a week, it went back to zero again. You couldn't, you know, the influx of masks just came into the country. And we couldn't sell them. And then we just had to keep on. We had little savings where my little Irish agent, I say little, he lives in an island of 3 million people. But Guinness, you know, the new rules, pub laws, that everyone had to stand outside the pubs. Now, it's always miserable and raining. They needed covers. And they phoned around. Then we had tried to get into Guinness for years. And suddenly none of the factories were open in Europe and Poland and Turkey. We said, we'll do it, typical South Africans. And huge order came in to make cover every pub in Ireland.
Wow.
And then in the US, LA school counties, we made a little shield for school desks that was able to fold and print it. It came up with the idea. I have to give my wife credit. She saw it on Instagram. Said, look at this thing as an idea. Made one, sent the photo, and we got a massive order out of US LA School County District. And tens of thousands of those. I could have given up. I'm just not going to do that anymore. Yeah. And yeah.
Well, so those moments.
But the problem is when you started, you're small and adaptable. When you're big, you're cumbersome.
Mm.
You've got now this big plant, so you've got to have that. Economies of scale, which always makes things tough.
And still be flexible to keep producing new products, right? So you got to balance these.
Problems. Correct, yeah.
What do you still want to do? What do you still want to achieve? On the one hand, so you've like, you've got into this business, grown it. It's been like start, stop, grow, but, you know, having to rebuild again and again and again. and you're probably going to keep doing that. But I saw on your website, you know, it's one day put a banner on Mars. Maybe that is a real ambition. But you know, what is it that you want to?
We've got one on the North Pole, so we did that. Yeah.
So what do you still want to achieve?
So I think, like all things, is just to be at some point. Take the pressure off. I love the development. I love the systems. I don't think retiring early is healthy. It may sound romantic, but you can only hit a golf ball so many times and you get bored. I still have my big passion is aviation and using aviation and conservation. That doesn't come cheap, so I need a successful business to fund that for me. So that passion's in there. And I'm still young. I'm not that old. So I do have an end game. I mean, the end game would always, I think every guy is to sell your business at the right time and to get out. But I think anyone who would buy in will hold me in for a while. So yeah, I think I've put a line in the sand that I have to get it to before I jump ship again. I want to own the USA. When I say own the USA, it's massive. And every South African goes in, you get, your eyes get all very excited. It's to hold the reins. And we drawn a line, that the size we'd like to get it to would be very proud. I don't think if any South Africans watch this, just remember, LA County's economy is bigger than the whole of South Africa. But it's full of snake oil. Yeah. You got to sift through a lot of rubbish to find out how to sell in that market.
You got to find your little niche, your spot, which almost certainly will be bigger than any market that you have in South Africa, multiple times of it. So
right.
I do think that for South Africans, starting businesses or growing businesses, we do struggle that the local market is very limited. And we don't have neighbors who have big markets either. You know, so if Zimbabwe was booming and Botswana was a huge economy, the same size as South Africa and more, and there's nobody south of us. We're not selling into the Indian Atlantic Ocean. You go to the US, you've got so many countries really all around you, and you can find expansion opportunities.
But Dom, we are the center of the world, eh? If you export to Europe, USA and Australia, think of it, we are the center of the world. So don't forget that.
That's true. So there's definitely advantages of being in South Africa, but I think the advantages come from our flexibility, our creativity, our ability to focus on a problem, solve it well, kind of in this middle space. We're never going to be high-end luxury production, the likes of Italy or France, but we also don't need to compete with China and India and Bangladesh and all the low-cost production. We don't need to do that.
Yeah. I mean, there are drone manufacturers in South Africa. Who would have thought, So there is, you say that once, so don't forget we build a lot of your Mercedes-Benz C-classes in South Africa.
So we built great products. I know of a guy, heard of a guy who basically makes springs. And he didn't get into this particularly first, made lots of different springs, but now produces one spring for mechanical actuators, switches. And he makes both those en masse. Very successful business. But has obviously figured out that in that space, there's something that customers particularly want for a particular type of application that they just can't easily get from a mass producer in China.
There's a book, The Top 500 Hidden Companies in the World. And to be a top, you got to be a $2 billion turnover, and it's brands that you and I don't know. So if you're a doctor, there's a stethoscope. That's the Rolls-Royce stethoscope, and it's a family-owned business for generations. They don't advertise nothing, but if you're a doctor, that's what you aspire to. And then there's a valve company in the oil industry. Same. They're in New York. Apparently you go down, it's only 5 staff for the Samba, but they've got this unique valve. Exactly. That's what you're saying. It's you've got to find that little slot for you.
And that's the future for us, I think, for South Africa, where we can be very competitive.
Yeah, and getting look, you've got to have a growing economy. So getting hands working and not being sad to say, we're manufacturers.
Mm.
We've got labor. It's here. Yeah. And this country, they talk about the word empowerment. And empowerment comes from having a job. And you're empowered. You earn a bit of money, and you educate your child, and your child advances, and that's how the next generation goes. But that'll only come from, like America in its heydays in the 80s, when everyone was basically a lot of blue-collar work and working in manufacturing.
Yeah. And I hear from what you were saying that's what gives you a lot of satisfaction in what you do, right, is that creating employment and what that employment does for – your staff and for their families and for the people who depend on them. And that's what we need. We need lots more of that in this country.
No, look, we do have one issue in South Africa that's the critical, and that's your price of your life.
Yeah.
You know, it can be like, but any big city, you know, I've been in Denver, Colorado, and I walked down the wrong road. And next when anyone says, what the hell are you doing there? You don't go there. People get stabbed. So the same thing, yeah, you just don't go to certain places. But there is that risk. If that's just we can get our hands on, we can deal with it. Yeah. I can deal with petty crime, but just don't threaten my family. That's the main call. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Gon. Appreciate the time. I wish you all the best.
Yeah.
We will continue to follow your business, but also the Bataleurs. I'm very interested to see how that keeps helping conservation. And thank you for everything you do. Wish you all the best.
No, well, thank you. Thanks for your thanks for reaching out there. And that's the other thing, you know, the LinkedIn. I mock social media until I got into it, and then it's incredible to how it opens doors. And don't be afraid to reach out to people. Talk. You just never know who the next person is.
Very true. Very true. Awesome. Yeah. Thanks so much. Wow, that was such an awesome episode with Donovan Bailey from Expander Brand. I've learned so much about his story there, how he took over a business from his father and made it a global brand. That is something really worth learning from, and I look forward to seeing his progress in future. If you want to join us on one of our social media sites, here is a list of them. Please, if you can nominate somebody you think is worthy of being a Silicon Springbok, we'd love to learn about them. And we look forward to seeing you on the next episode. Bye-bye.